being that the source sheet's a little bit delayed, I want to talk about Ramitel anyway, but then we'll segue into a little bit of Lamdas. The Jewish people arrive at Mara, and it's a few weeks before Har Sinai, and it's clear that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is employing the opportunity at Mara to train them about the notion of mitzvahs. Baruch Hashem, we take mitzvahs for granted. Tadah Rabah. Baruch Hashem, we take mitzvahs for granted, but the notion of living a life that's regulated, leading a sudden life as a mitzvah v'yosa, it's not simple for the human imagination. Man is born free. We're free creatures. What differentiates us from the animals is our freedom of choice. That's part of our tzelem elokim. Animals are creatures of habit and of instincts. They're driven by hormones. They're driven by primal forces in nature, seasons, mating patterns. We make decisions. We have a cognitive will and a moral conscience, and we impose the will and our conscience upon our decisions. So the notion that we're going to suspend our freedom, of course, to achieve a higher freedom, we believe that religion yields a higher freedom. At the very least, it gives us immortality, it gives us the next world, not just this world. Hopefully, we also see it as an elixir for life in this world, that religion allows us to live freer than we would otherwise, even though on the surface we look circumscribed and we look bound, but we know that unlimited freedom can itself be a form of enslavement and tyranny, addiction, and lack of self-control and self-discipline. But it's hard. It's hard for the human imagination to conjure such a life. So about a couple of weeks before Har Sinai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu introduces some training mitzvahs to train us to the notion of mitzvahs. Which three mitzvahs are introduced? So take a look at the back of your page. This week's parasha, Parshas B'Shalach, a very famous Varta Rav Amitai. Sham Samlo Chok U'Mishpat B'Sham Nisal. At Mara, HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered three mitzvahs to test us. B'Sham Nisal. Chok U'Mishpat B'Sham Nisal. So Rashi famously comments, what were the three mitzvahs the Rabbonu Shalom selected? Source number base, according to our version has Shabbos, Paraduma, Vedinin. Now I say our version because in some of the Mamari Chazal, you have Shabbos, Pei Aleph, and Dinin. And Pei Aleph would refer to Paraduma. But in some manuscripts, it's not Pei Aleph, but Kaf Aleph. Kaf and Pei are very similar letters. And that would refer to not Paraduma, but Kibbut Avraim. So some versions have their bonus on delivering Shabbos, Kibbut Avraim, and Dinim. But our read is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers Shabbos, Paraduma, and Dinim. Now why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu choose these three mitzvahs? So the bookends make a lot of sense. The bookends are actually quite coherent. Shabbos is theologically important. I fear that in our day, we're starting to lose track of Shabbos as a theological experience because it's been so neatly wedded to common convenience. We live in such a wired and busy world that we thirst for Shabbos. The college girls can tell us how much you probably appreciate Shabbos more than you ever did because your life is just so frantic and so pressurized and you don't have time for people. And I'm happy, and certainly the Shabbos project has capitalized upon that by popularizing Shabbos to an audience that doesn't have necessarily theological sensitivities, and that's legitimate and welcome. But Shabbos is Shabbos Lashem. Ki sheish yisav mas Hashem es Hashemayim gezaretz. I remember a couple of years ago speaking to the boys about the difference between Shabbos that coheres or accommodates the human need for family time and quiet time, and Shabbos Lashem, where sometimes in life you'll find yourself in an airport or stuck somewhere or in a cold framework, and we don't have that too often. Our grandparents and great-great-grandparents and our ancestors, they suffered Shabbos, but they experienced Shabbos very differently, without hot plates and without heat, without light, and of course travel. If you travel for weeks and months on end. So you spend Shabbos on roadsides, by rivers and forests, all sorts of areas where you just have to cease and stop your life. I remember giving that chair to the boys during the winter, and then that Friday night there was a blackout, and we didn't have heat, and we didn't have light, and we didn't have food, we had nothing, and I told my family, Shabbos Lashem, they started stoning me, forget Shabbos Lashem, we want our food, we want our heat. But every once in a while, you're reminded. This past Friday night, I was sitting with one of my children, and I don't want to be too specific about it, but that child was experiencing a situation in which that child was very, very uncomfortable. I'll just tell you a story about one of the Rebbeim in Yeshiva. One of the Bayam Yeshiva, I won't mention his name, long, long time ago, 30-plus years ago, broke his leg at the onset of Shabbos. Now, if you're living in West Hampton, you break your leg, you're called a Cholish and Afalamita, you're someone who is significant enough of a chola that you can't violate the arises, because that's like pikuach nefesh, zakanas nefashos, but you can't violate the rabbanon. So you pick up the phone, which is the rabbanon, you call a geisha, a non-Jewish taxi cab driver, you go to the hospital, and you're in good hands. In Eretz Yisrael, you live in the West Bank, there's no non-Jewish taxi drivers that you can trust with your safety. So the only option is calling a Jewish taxi driver, which would entail potentially Melech HaShabbos D'oraisa. Either you or the taxi driver, it doesn't make a difference from that standpoint. You can't put it on someone else. So this Rebbe just basically broke his leg at the beginning of Shabbos and just sat in his chair all Shabbos with a broken leg. He was waiting for Shabbos to end. And do you have that type of Shabbos courage when you get into these difficult situations and you cut corners sometimes and you'll rip something or tear something or commit bor error? Sometimes because you just need to have that convenience, and those are moments you have to be able to rally and say Shabbos Lashem. I literally had this episode with one of my children Friday night. There was something that happened, whatever, and I was very, very, very uncomfortable, and the only way out would have basically been to stay up all night and not go to sleep, because if that person went to sleep, it would have entailed a certain situation. And I said, okay, I have to stay up. You can't go to sleep. You can't violate Shabbos because you need to sleep. Shabbos is aser. It turned out we were afraid that that child may fall asleep and get into potentially a very, very remote, but potentially a life-threatening situation. So I paskin, they may have to tear something and take a scissors and cut it, because any time there's even a hint or a trace of some kind of sephashos, then you have to respond to it. But my message to my child was, this is what Shabbos is. And you don't prioritize your convenience, and that if Shabbos happens to accord, but chas v'shalom, of cold food or be cold, or I've slept, I mean, I hope it doesn't happen this Shabbos, but I've slept many Shabbos in freezing cold with blankets on. And so Shabbos has a theological component that I'm worrying is becoming more and more absent and more obscured. But it's also not just important theologically, it's a good mitzvah to train people, because it isn't that onerous. It's once a week, and you're able to try it on for size and to experience it. So if a ger were to come to me, a person, a woman or a man undergoing conversion, and ask me, yes, give me a mitzvah to try on for size. I try Shabbos. It's a bris of Am Yisrael. It's a Jewish experience. It's community. A lot of good reasons that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Shabbos to deliver in Mara. Azmi Sinai, and it's Tavor Lav. It's every year, every week on during Musaf. Azmi Sinai, from Har Sinai, a little bit before Har Sinai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us for Shabbos. That makes sense. Dinim, even more important. We all live as individuals. We all live in a society. Many different levels of society. We live in communities. This is a community, educational communities. Some of the girls now are in secondary educational communities. Mirz Hashem, in a couple of years, you'll be starting to build your own community. It's a good word to use when you start dating. When you marry a person, love is important and friendship is important. There has to be some element that together we're going to build a society. Together we're going to build a community. And that has to enter into at least another conversation, because it's still premature, you're not discussing, but in some sense in your awareness, in your modality. This is a person that together we're going to be community builders. And we're going to build a community called a family. We're going to dedicate time to the family. And we're going to hopefully see a large community so much. And today, I'm very proud today in Yeshiva, we're having a Yom Iyun, a mini Yom Iyun on Avodas Hashem in mental health. So we're inviting a psychologist to speak to them about self-esteem. It's the first session, running back for it. We have to daven mincha 3:45, so can't daven mincha later. Second section is actually an anonymous person. I won't tell you his name, but someone in the community, an older person, who is going to talk about internet addiction and pornography, and is going to share his personal experiences with them. I'm absolutely not going to record that. He wants it to be anonymous. And the third section is OCD and halacha. And I think it's important for us to have a better awareness, especially in a stressful period, stressful era. And so much of life, so much of the pressures in life and the forgeries of life is when people don't have self-esteem. If I could embed one healthy character trait to every single person in your age, it would be self-esteem. People that don't have self-esteem are apt to solicit it in very unhealthy ways from others, or to be victimized by others looking for self-esteem, or probably both. It's true in life that most people who are abusers are also victims of manipulating other people. It's generally true in life. And self-esteem, if you're content with yourself, and essentially self-esteem has to start from within. It has to be independent. It can't be if you feel good about yourself. And I mentioned dating before, and I'm sure you all look like healthy young women, but you know, there's some boys out there that don't know the first thing about conveying self-esteem to women in general, to other people. You know, obviously, if there's any hint or trace whatsoever that that person is not capable of, and do you feel like a better person? Do you feel like a more esteemed person, a more validated person? If not, I mean, you have no business even going on another minute. I mean, that's like ABCs of relationship, validation and affirmation and self-esteem. So that's to come from within. But to a degree. That's speaking for my family. Family is a place of safety, should be a place of safety, where who you are is accepted regardless of your accomplishments. And if any of the accomplishments are meaningless, then I'm interested in how the world sees you or what public accolades you accomplish. You're just, you're a healthy person because you know that there are, I know there are close to 15 people in my life that are just my immediate nuclear family that are, that's who I live with. That's who I'm experiencing my time Shabbos with. And we check our egos at the door, and we're not interested in who accomplishes. I mean, we'll support one another, but we're just interested in common experience. So, anyway, so societies we build. Societies have to have a moral element and a visionary element. So I was laughing to myself because I saw an article, I think, in the New York Post or something. I still, like, I'm addicted to my old tabloids. I go online. I think it was the New York Post. Someone editorial. I've been saying this for 20 years already. What America needs to rebuild its social fabric is national service. I mean, it's so obvious. If every single American high schooler, a year after high school or a year or two after McDonald's, and gosh, if they contributed and they went off to some distant city and they contributed voluntarily to some larger ideal in a common fashion that breaks hierarchies and breaks division. And we know this in our country. Our social fabric is so strong, in part, not only in part because of Sir Army, because of Sir Lumi. And when you're in the Army, it doesn't make a difference your skin color. It doesn't make a difference your culture, your ethnicity, your yes religious, no religious. It's a great equalizer. It's a great leveler effect. And it creates a common bond that I'm jealous I didn't. I came a little bit too late to serve in the Army. I feel like I've been deprived of that entree into my people and their social fiber. So the judicial system, and some people say dinim is just the laws of mishpatim and the laws of Bava Kamma. That's the kernel. But the goal is to create societies, societies of trust, societies of common interests, societies of moral goals and moral desires. And to a degree, I think law and morality don't always synchronize. I think we've created societies of law. I'm not sure how much we've created societies of morality and ethics, and sometimes looking in the way of ethics, because that's the great Mishnah, Perkei Avos, Shali Shali Shulcha Shulcha. An absolute legal society is Midas Tov. And you think about Midas Tov, they were terrible. They were horrendous. They were offensive. But you start by being a society of law, Shali Shali Shulcha Shulcha. And then you slip precipitously into a society of immorality and abuse and hostilities and manipulation. So those two mitzvahs are eminently logical. Why HaKadosh Baruch Hu begins with those two mitzvahs? But Parah Adumah, the third mitzvah Hashem offers us as an exhibition, as an exercise in training, is Parah Adumah? It's preposterous. It's preposterous on many levels. Number one, there's no Mishkan. You don't need to be tar. Not only is there no tar, there is no Tumah V'Tahara. Tumah V'Tahara begins at Har Sinai. Before Har Sinai, you can touch a dead body and you're not Tumah. Tumah is a legal reality. Tumah is not, a person touches a dead body, they're not less of a person. That's why one of the great misunderstandings, you have to be careful about the way you speak. If you teach him, again, one day when you get married, you'll learn Hilchos Nida. And you'll say, oh, in this case, I'm Tumah. In that case, I'm Tumah. And people on the outside, oh my goodness, how could we have such a chauvinistic, misogynist view of women? They're not Tumah is just a halachic term, which means you can't come into the Beis HaMikdash. It's not reflective of any spiritual level. Moshe Rabbeinu was Tumah 40 years because he took Atzmos Yosef and Parshas B'Shalach. If you interview Moshe, 90% of the time, he's Tumah because he's a big tzaddik and he's bearing a mace mitzvah. And you can be Tumah after the most lofty and noble pursuits. Tumah is just the state. It doesn't reflect lesser or more. It just means you now have come into contact with death. You shouldn't come into the Beis HaMikdash. You now come into contact with internal biological death in your own bodies. You shouldn't come into the Beis HaMikdash during that point. It's not. Again, to the outside, as they hear the word Tumah or it's treif and it's Tumah, so you have to be careful about the way you speak. And if you go to the mikvah 100 times, it's just because you want to have a higher spiritual level. Again, Chassidus and Kabbalah, but Tumah V'Tahara is halachic labels that come and go based on halachic activities which are amoral. There's no moral. I mean, sometimes they're moral, but sometimes they're reversed morally. You're Tumah because you're being involved in an important mitzvah. So before the Mishkan, before Har Sinai, no one's Tumah in Torah. And not only that, there's no kohanim to process the paraduma. So of all the mitzvahs to deliver, paraduma. It's very odd, very peculiar. So let me share what Rav Amital told us about this paraduma. This was a B'Shalach Sicha. We all waited for it. It always came around B'Shalach. Two B'Shalach. The two things we waited for B'Shalach, number one, the Rav Amital Sicha about the paraduma. And normally B'Shalach in Yisrael was around the time of Tu B'Shvat. Right, Tu B'Shvat on Sunday or something.
So Rav Amital was very suspicious in his day of fake emotionalism, of instant spontaneity. So he didn't like the whole Karlbach movement. Today, Baruch Hashem, it's become much more popular, much more mainstream, but he was very suspicious of it. So we'd always be fomenting to have a Karlbach Kabbalah Shabbos, and Rav Amital would always be resisting. So he told us, if Tu B'Shvat is Chal on Shabbos and there's a snowstorm, we can have a Karlbach Shabbos. And every once in a while, it happened. Tu B'Shvat was Chal on Shabbos and it was a snowstorm, we had a Karlbach. Like, it happened three times in history, but now, thank God, in Gush, we have a Karlbach Minyan every Friday night.
wait, what does that mean? He's against... What
Rav Amital was very opposed to false, pretentious behavior. And he felt that, at least to him, it seemed like this instant dancing and singing wasn't authentic, it was just formulaic. Let's sing and dance on demand. Let's flip the switch. Today, I think the role of simcha and of dance and of song in our society has become more institutionalized. I don't think everyone goes to a Karlbach davening and feeling a spiritual high. It's a nice feeling. It's nice to sing. In those days, it was much more polarized. People daven, and then people, the happy minion, people danced and jumped. And now everyone just, I remember... Remember when we filmed, we always film a little video for the boys coming into yeshiva, the madrichim film a little welcome video. So they always do some shtick. And this year, the shtick they did was, each rebbe had to say their favorite part of yeshiva. Like, what's your favorite time in yeshiva? So I said, my favorite time in yeshiva is really Kabbal Shabbos. I just love, we always dance Karlbach. And in the middle of the dancing, the entire base matters makes one big circle. And it's just like looking at the variety and the diversity. Israelis and Americans and older and younger and Darkino and South Africans and Australians and this one and that one and visitors. It's like, it's a real Am Yisrael feel that everyone's together in this one big circle. And just I'm happy to be part of that process. So we're all dancing. We know it's like jumping and giggling and calisthenics. It's become part of the Kabbalah Shabbos feel. Right? We all know it. I'm not so musically inclined. Even I can daven a Karlbach. I don't have to be a Karlbach daven. Even I can lead a Karlbach Kabbalah Shabbos. Anyway, so we also waited for the Sicha. And to answer this question, Rav Amital told us the story of Dama ben Nesina. Famous Gemara in Kiddushin, source number Gimel. Dama ben Nesina was a very wealthy non-Jew living in Ashkelon. And one year, he discovered these huge gemstones. Now, the Kohen Gadol's attire had two different gems. There were the 12 gems that were inserted to the little slots in the Choshen, the smaller stones. But then two huge, gigantic gemstones on either shoulder, on the ephod. These were called the Avnei HaEphod. And they essentially function as suspenders. These large suspenders holding up the meal, and they're holding up the ephod, and these held them, at least fastened them in place. Huge gemstones are very scarce and very expensive. So this Gentile was about to cash in. You know the story, you probably studied it in high school, very famous Gemara. Chazal visited this Gentile in Ashkelon, and his father was sleeping on the key that could open the safe in which these gemstones were being safeguarded. So Dama ben Nesina decided not to wake his father up and thereby forgo on all the money he could have profited from. So first of all, I tell my kids every year, please, if it ever happens to me, please wake me up. Don't go all righteous on me, okay? I would much rather. You wake me up every night anyway. Much rather lose a little sleep and cash out. So trust me, girls. If it happens to you, I think I can talk for your parents. They probably want you to wake them up. Don't say, but Abba, I followed the Gemara and Kiddush. No! If it's Gemara, you decide to follow the Gemara and Kiddush. I won't go that route. So for whatever reason, someone comes to your house, and your father or your mother can make a lot of dough, and you're asleep, don't go, oh, the Gemara and Kiddush, and a big tzaddik. Now's not the time for people that are big tzaddikim. Anyway, this guy, this Dama ben Nesina, forwent on all the money. Hashem rewarded him. And the next year, a paraduma was born into his flock. Now, if you think the Avnei HaEphod are valuable, this is scale, this is Shark Tank, this is millions and billions of, this isn't just your local nickel and dime Avnei HaEphod. This is a cool mill. And now the Chacham knew they had to pay up even more. So they came with their money bags. And this Dama ben Nesina said something very odd. He said, don't give me the money of paraduma. I don't want that money. I don't want the million. Last year, I lost quarter of a mil on Kibbutz Avayim, because I respected my parents. Pay me back. Pay me the Kibbutz Avayim money. Don't pay me the paraduma money. Strange, right? Last year I lost money because of Kibbutz Avayim. That money I won. Paraduma money, keep it for yourself. Strange Gemara. Classic Rav Amital ability to read this Gemara metaphorically and not just literally. The Gentile was an honest Gentile. In his mind, religion is purely cognitive and rational. Kibbutz Avraham he gets. And if he feels he deserves money for Kibbutz Avraham. He went to the mat last year for Kibbutz Avraham. He deserves to be paid. Kibbutz Avraham makes eminent sense, logic. You can't build a society without a family, I said before. The great failure of Soviet Union was the premise that they could build a society in the absence of family structure. They stripped kids away from their young parents and they raised them in communal settings. To a degree, that's why he collapsed. Rampant alcoholism, lack of family structure. Just family is a building block. Imagine building a pyramid. You build the building blocks of families. Of course, it has to be lumped together with something larger, but you need to build on families. You even see in our world, those cultures, forget Jews, those cultures that have strong family units and strong family respect of elders, they tend to be robust, reproducible. You could take them and replant them to a degree. I don't want to sound in any way racist or stereotypical, but generally, Asian cultures are known for really respecting family. You go to any modern Western society, there's been transplanted Asian cultures that have been highly, highly successful, educationally, family, to their credit. And unfortunately, you've got other cultures that are still mired in rampant, rampant family dysfunction, and it's cyclical, and it cycles back generation after generation, and it just can't escape it. I mean, I'm not saying this in any way to be racist. It's part of the plague that continues to haunt the African-American culture. They haven't been able to break that cycle of absentee fathers and families. Again, not everyone, but as a culture, it's hard and it's frustrating. Because you want to be able to break out of that cycle, and it's the source of such agitation and frustration. And the guy realizes that Kibbutz Avraham is the bedrock of a family life, respecting elders and tending to elders. And so he's willing to take money for that, but he says, my religion doesn't accommodate the realm of the irrational. And Paraduma is the quintessential chok. It's completely irrational. And it's not just irrational, it's a mystery wrapped in an enigma. A, it doesn't make sense. Why should burning some red heifer's ashes and sprinkling it in a mixture of water confer tahara? But it's not just mysterious, it's enigmatic, and it's counterintuitive, because if I'm one of the Kohanim processing the Paraduma and relieving your Tuma, I become Tame. So the custodians and the agents who are conferring Tahara become Tame. And not only is it inaccessible, it's confounding. It's the quintessential Chok, Zos Chukas HaTorah. And it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of reminding us we don't know it all. We can't know it all. And that's why Paraduma relieves death, because death is the dead end of human experience. We can't supersede death. We can't understand it. We don't know. It's the collapse of the human experience. And Hashem tells us that the only response to death is some, when you're tummy, because you come into contact with death, is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to descend and solve it for you in a way that's not rational, beyond human comprehension, beyond human cognition. And it's a metaphor. It's not just death, but it's other deaths in our life, mental deaths, deaths where human intelligence and human imagination halt and cease, and we can't break through that barrier, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will has to allow us to transcend those barriers, just like we transcend death through Paraduma. And this Gentile was just honest. He said, I'll be honest with you. I know that I was heroic last year. It's in sync with my religious identity, so I deserve to be compensated for that. But it's Paraduma, I can't wrap my head around that. I don't deserve money for it. It's a statement not just about his keeper of aim, but his honesty and his integrity. And part of what makes our Avodas Hashem so powerful is that it weds both. And I think what makes Judaism so buoyant is this interplay between Chukim and Mishpatim, Chukav Mishpatav L'Yisrael, Lo Asachem L'Chogai, Mishpatim Bal Yidon, the ability to create a mixture of cognitive, rational religion which we understand and can justify within the human experience, and just recognition, not just with mitzvahs. It's so important. We live in such a hyper-empirical world, but we live in such a small space, and we make believe this space is the totality of reality. And it isn't. It's just the space we occupy and just the world we live in. It's not the entire universe. It's certainly not the upper realms that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created. And the world of ration, which we feel so comfortable in, that we live as creatures of ration and of science, Baruch Hashem. I much prefer the world we inhabit. And it's especially important for the girls who are in college at this stage, because so much of your behavior, and don't get me wrong, We live in a very, very dangerous world. I'm sure you've heard the suspicious view of intellectualism, that if you use your brain, and that's somewhat antithetical to being from, and there's polarity or binary sense. You can either be from or be smart, or be smart or be from. And the brain is an incredible, incredible tool. Incredible tool. Science has pushed back the frontiers of almost every part of the human body except for the brain. We're first starting to map the brain. So Mamash Nisim and the philosopher Kadosh Baruch Hu. And like any tool, you want to develop it. You want to get it to work better. And so I have to tell you something. I find myself with people, and they're just, I'm not saying this in a condescending way, just their brains don't work well. It's not a question of how smart you are. Working well is within, I'm not, if I took an IQ test, I would score very, very low compared to, very low. And I don't have scintillating intellect. I can't cut through math equations. I mean, I studied math, but it's very, very, I've tried to train my mind to be very methodical and very gradual and staged. It's training. It's something training yourself to set the field of vision. What are you studying? Don't be disrupted or disturb everything. It's out of the field of vision. Go slowly. What's step one? What's step two? Again, once you repeat them, then it happens more rapidly. It's a process. But train your minds, and especially when you're in university and college, take this opportunity. Know that some of these courses you'll be studying, which may seem remotely relevant to your life. You're studying algebra, you're studying calculus, you're studying science. What difference does it make? I mean, I'm in the grocery store, I'll pull out my calculator, I need to study Pythagorean theory to pay for my grocery bill. First of all, you're understanding the foundations of our universe. The foundations of the universe at some level are math, which I've created a world predicated on math. But also, you're training your mind to work well. And when your mind works well, you'll see all the static in life gets eliminated, just clear thinking. Sometimes you feel like you're talking to someone, and there's a lot of static coming through, and a lot of disjointed sentences, and that makes you feel like this is a clear transmission. This is someone who speaks, and that's also important, girls. Try as best as you can. I'm speaking to both the Israelis and the Americans. In my house, if I ever hear my kids say this, I slam my fist on the table. I hate those words, ki'ilu, ki'ilu, ki'ilu. It just deadens language. It's assassinating language. Because you have so much ideas, and they can be potent and powerful, and just these are dead weight that you impose on your senses, and they make the whole sentence fall apart in America, and like. Just please, please, take it out of you, but catch yourself. These are verbal tics, and they become addictive, and unless you decidedly focus on eliminating them, you'll be straddled with them your whole life, and your language will be half the potency it can occupy. Train yourself, catch yourself, you take the word like. Don't say, even if you want to use the word like in the proper context, just spend an entire year, pledge to yourself, you'll never use the word like. Even if the person behind the ice cream bar says, do you like vanilla? Say, I prefer vanilla. I'm attracted to something. Just please, or kids, I promise you, you'll thank you. Forget everything I taught you, but one day you'll see an old man walking with a cane and say, Rabbi Tarek Emanishma. Straight, clean, lucid. Shut my phone and my watch. Straight, clean, powerful language. But this cockiness and this premise that whatever exists beyond the realm of our ration and our science. In 1889, the French minister, the science ministry, got up and announced that we're going to close the patent office because everything that needs to be invented and discovered has already been invented and discovered in 1889. You can imagine, we have trains, and we have coal, and we have steamboats, and we've discovered electricity. We can stop, right? We're there. And I'm sure in 100 years, people will look back at us and laugh and get a heart attack. At our science, the same way we look back, that I can promise you. I promise you that people will look back at you and say, wait a second, girls, how'd you get here? You climbed into a tin can and burned fossil fuels 12 hours over the ocean. That sounds pretty odd. We leap into our hydroscopter and we burn fusion energy with light node capsules and we're there in 10 minutes. That's funny, really, Ima? You got to a tin can and you sat upright for 12 hours? Wow, how'd you go to the bathroom? You'll say, please, don't make me share that. Too graphic, not for children. There are children in the room. It's rated G, rated PG, rated R. So we'll laugh at today. Okay, it's the science we have. It's the science that empowers us and change our world. And we don't have to be distrustful, chas v'shalom, of science, the demonizing of it. But it's not just, while I'm able to process rational mitzvahs, I'm able to process irrational. It's more modalities of life. Do you live a rational reality along with a mystical reality? Be able to accept that there are realms your eyes can't see. Be able to accept that there are prophetic forces driving history that you may not be aware of, that are larger than life and larger than politics and larger. Trust me, whoever gets elected in the next 2 months, it won't make any impact in the larger historical trajectory. There are larger forces and moral energy, and there are metaphysical forces that drive humanity. And to be able to live in this world, it's hard, because those people tend to tilt towards metaphysics and supernaturalism and mysticism and things your eyes can't trace tend to be very dubious and skeptical of ration and science. And those who are hyper-rationalists tend to be, and can you create that combination? It's more than just mitzvahs. I excel at Shabbos and excel at Paraduma. It's more modalities. Can I accept those different truths to my life and operate within those truths and know that my actions have impact and far beyond the world that I can trace and far beyond the world that I inhabit? And can I go to college and really absorb everything the college has to offer, aside from the primary reference point that this is where it begins and ends? The college is if the world of science and rationalism bounds my experience. Can I indulge in it and draw as much as I can from it without surrendering to its basic premises? And to a degree, that's really the way you deal with today's culture. There's so much in our culture that's attractive, but only if you don't enslave yourself to its emotional tyranny. The beautiful Chasam Sofer in Parshas Bo, why didn't the Jews just walk out during Choshech? The Egyptians can't move, so walk away. He basically says, I'm adapting it. It wasn't enough for the Jews to be liberated. They had to defy, they had to rebel. They had to walk out Bereish Gale in open view. Because if they just escaped, they still would have felt the tuggings of the Egyptian culture and the emotional tyranny of being lorded over and persecuted. Sometimes in life, and of course for us, leaving Egypt isn't leaving Egypt, but leaving the world and being able to liberate ourselves from the influence of this world. I see a lot of this today. I see a lot of people who are able to maintain halachic lifestyles and not perform any isurim, but there's an emotional enslavement to the values of our culture, to the celebrities in our culture, to sports and to celebrity and to Hollywood And they're able to draw the line, and we're not going to violate any Yisurim, but there's a heroicization and almost like an admiration that creates an emotional taxing that's more sometimes dangerous than just whether or not it can't be dangerous than more dangerous than an Isser. But I see a lot of people who are otherwise religious and dati, but their hearts are very, not enslaved, but very captivated, enchanted with the values and the people who stand for those values. And to be free is to be free existentially, not just to be free mechanically. How do I choose my behavior? What am I involved in? But to be free as a person and to be able to be part of this culture and be part of the technology and part of the culture and part of the values, but not admire them too much or admire them disproportionately. Admire people. I always tell when boys ask me when they're about to go to university, I say, don't admire professors because of their brilliance or because of how eloquent they speak. Try to find people you admire because they're moral people. And you can tell. You've met some professors. It's just good people leading good lives, and you admire them for that, not because they're so brilliant and not because they deliver such riveting lectures. Those are tools. Those are talents. Talents can be acquired. They can be acquired like any talent. Moral life is sustained moral experience, self-sacrifice, selflessness, commitment. I remember with great fondness the time that I was in university. I met, in general, the time when I learned so much from so many people from so many different walks of life. But I always tried to train my eye not on how impressive their intellect was and how inspirational their speech was. Who they are as people, going to get beyond the tongue and beyond the public mask and try to get a sense of who they are as people. And I was able to feel their humanity shining through. And I really respected those people. And other people I felt just didn't have that lifestyle. It didn't interest me how bright they were. Intelligence is very overrated in my opinion. I'm not intimidated by people with high IQs or people who can, it doesn't shake me. It doesn't move me. Anyway, so this is how Rav Amital described Mara. And Mara was a training ground for religious consciousness. And to train religious consciousness, we had to both operate in the cognitive realm and in the irrational realm. We had to accept mitzvahs which our minds and our human hearts could rationalize, and the mitzvahs which we just can't make sense of it. And we won't always make sense of our lives. History is confounding.
halacha sometimes is perplexing. Beretz Hashem, I hope you all have really, really wonderful and blessed lives and lives of ease and lives. You don't know what happens. Lives change. The trajectories change suddenly. You're thrown curveballs and you can't always make sense of it. And you're able to sometimes to accept the mystery of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just in mitzvos, but in our world, in our experience, in our day to day, not just in our ritual. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if you can't accept Paradumi, you're not yet ready for Har Sinai. Show me that you can just close your eyes and say, I don't understand Paradumi. One day we will. I promise you we will. Somehow makes sense to us. We'll see death and we'll see ashes and we'll see cows and all the colors. All come streaming into our minds and we'll all get that sense. Oh, how could I have missed it? It's obvious, right? Someone's dead. You burn a red heifer and you put the ashes into water and you spread. Like, of course, 3 and 7 makes total sense. We just don't have the capacity right now. We're operating in a limited fashion. So with whatever capacitors we have, we try to understand, but they're just so limited. When the Medrash talks about the aura of Sheshis and Mebereshis, the light that allow people to see from one end of the world to the other, and you know, we can barely see past the fog on Migdal Oz. So this type of ethereal, supernal light that I can understand everything. Imagine if all of a sudden you flip the switch and you got all of physics and all of radio astronomy and all of astrophysics and all of chemistry. Oh, yeah. Oh, that explains that. Now I understand what a black hole is. Now I understand where, you know, is Pluto a planet? big. Oh, now we know. It's part of 300 million other galaxies. It's just we're operating such limited. It's like I find it laughable when people are just so cocky and we now know everything and we know what we know and we have to proceed based on what we know, but not pitch it or cast it as if it's a total sweep of all knowledge and all reality. Okay, let's take a little bit of time. We have about 15 minutes left after we have the early mincha because we have our mental health day waiting us. But just very briefly, I wanted to discuss a little bit of the alumnus of Kanayim Poganbo, third sugya. We talked about the halachas of Pshara. We talked about the role of Sanhedrin Agadola. So the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, I tried to quote as many sources as I can, says that there are three types of people that lone wolf vigilantes can execute justice for. Person who steals a klei sharis. If you see someone stealing a klei sharis in the Beis HaMikdash, you don't have to go through due process. You can execute him right there on the spot. Hamakalel bekosem, which is something akin to a blasphemer. And Habo'al aramis kanayim pogimba. This is the Gemara Mishnah in Sanhedrin, Pei Aleph from the base. Habo'al aramis kanayim pogimba. We all know the halacha, and of course we all know the story. The classic Aramis, the classic Kanai was Pinchas, and the classic Boal Aramis was Zimri. So Pinchas takes his spear and spears a Zimri and Cusby during the act without waiting for Beis Din. Now, the question, again, this is just 10 minutes of Lamdas, just to give you an orientation, is when the Kanai executes Zimri, to a degree it will sound, it will evoke some of the issues we talked about 3 weeks ago with Pshara. Remember we talked about Pshara? Whether a compromise is just another manner for Beis Din to adjudicate, or it's something extra legal, it's not part of Beis Din, it's like what we call arbitration, mediation, it's not part of Beis Din. Similar question arises with Kanayim Poganbo. The ability for Pinchas to execute Zimri on the spot, is it because essentially he's an extension of Beis Din? Beis Din, because there's a Chilul Hashem, it's mushrooming, and someone's got to halt the danger. You can self-deputize. Okay, I need Shlech Beitin, v'ani tapel ba'adam azel afnei shenagia lebeitin, v'ani Shlech Beitin. Or, halacha allows for autonomous authorities to operate without being under the aegis of Beis Din. So is Pinchas a Shlech Beitin, or is Pinchas operating outside of Beis Din because the Chilul Hashem is just so overwhelming that someone has to stop him, but not because he's Beis Din's agent who's operating in the absence of Beis Din. So I want to discuss 3 or 4 questions that crop up, and then I'll show you that a tool of Lamdas where once you see things in Rishonim that are very clear, you can go back and see it already in the Amoraim. It's always true that the further downstream you are in the Masara, the clearer your language will be because it's less intuitive, the ideas. So you have to be more articulate. When you go back 2,000 years, they knew it so well, they just snapped their fingers and they said things in codes and everyone knew what they were. So when you read a Rambam and a Rav, the Rambam and the Rav had a machlokus about the following point. Now let's go back to Rav and Shmuel, and it seems like they were arguing about that also, but they were finger snappers. I call Chazal finger snappers. They're whisperers. They just whispered, and they knew. Again, I'm not a girl, so I don't know, but when I talk to boys, like boys know sports so well, they can just say a sports star, and they'll know 50 plays of that player intuitively, and they don't have to organize them. This play, it's like,
50 ideas flared over their heads. So Chazal knew Torah the way boys know sports. They were obsessed with it. It was in their blood. It just, you said an idea and everything came rattling out. So for example, it's machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid, source number 3. Kol ha-boil kusis, the Rambam writes, in Hilchos Yisuribiyah. Yisuribiyah is in the section called Kedusha. Kol ha-boil kusis, bein derech chasnos, bein derech snos, imbala b'farhaset, whether he's marrying her, whether he's just having a prostitution, and 10 people are watching. In Paguba, line number 2, Kanoim, if the Kanoim intercede, Hare'ilu Meshubachim, Vizrizim, Vidavarze, Halachal Moshe Misinaihu, Raya Ladavar, Maisa Pinchas Vizimri. So it's Halachal Moshe Misin, it's not written in the Psukim, but this episode of Pinchas highlights the ability. Now the Ravid, who comments on the Rambam in the bold letters, he says, wait a second, the Rambam omitted something. Chasef HaRavid Zal, when can the Kanoi intercede? Shehisrubo, only with a warning. Namely, the Rambam and the Ravid have a debate whether Pinchas has to warn Zimri. Can he just spear him or he has to warn him? The Rambam describes the activities of the Kanoi without a Hasra. The Ravid interjects, hey, wait a second, what happened to the Hasra? In your mind, between the Rambam and the Ravid, who holds that the Kanoi is operating as an agent of Beis Din? Who holds that he's operating as a lone wolf vigilante? If the Rambam does not require Hasra, but the Ravid does require Hasra, Hasra is reflective of his autonomy or of his being an agent of Beis Din? Agent of Beis Din. If he has to warn, go through the normal process of Beis Din. So the Rambam, who omits Hasra, may hold that he's an autonomous agent, whereas the Ravid, who demands Hasra, may hold that he's an extension of Beis Din. Note, interestingly enough, okay, where does the Rambam quote the halachas of Kanoi and Pogimbo? Can anyone finish the sentence? If a Kanoi, Pinchas, was an extension of Beis Din, where should the Rambam insert the halachas? In which section? Hilchos? Sanhedrin. Where does the Rambam cite the halachas of Kanoi and Hilchos Isiribiyah? So further evidence that the Rambam does not see the episode of the Kanoi as an extension of Beis Din. And we talked about this a little bit with Pshara. Where would the Rambam cite the halachas of Pshara? Is Pshara a Beis Din imposed supervised activity, or it's independent extra-legal arbitration? So the Rambam was so careful and precise about his mapping that you can draw ideas from the decisions about where to catalog certain halachas. So if I were writing, or if the Ravid were writing it, he may include it in his Hilchos Sanhedrin, because you follow the normal rules of Beis Din. Or, as the Rambam writes a little bit later on, okay, source number 6, Avo Yisrael Haba Alakusis Ben Kitana, if the Jew has this bia with a Gentile woman, Ben Kitana Bashel Oshanim V'yom Echad Ben Gedola, whether the non-Jewish woman is a Kitana or a Gedola, as long as she's 3 years old, at which point the sexual activity has meaning. Afilo, line number 2, source 6. Now the Rambam talks about not the age of the Gentile woman, but the age of the Jewish perpetrator. Afilo Haya Katan Ben Tes Yamim V'yom Echad. Even if the male Jew is 9 years old, at which point his sexual activity becomes meaningful, you can still spear him. So the Rambam says that the laws of Haboel Aramis, Kanoim Pogimbo, apply to a Katan. What does that suggest? That it's a Beis Din instituted punishment or intervention independent of Beis Din? If we're Beis Din, you can't punish a Katan. A Katan isn't susceptible or obligated to the laws of Beis Din. So there's consistency in the Rambam. A katan can be speared if he's the perpetrator. B, you don't need hasra. C, the Rambam lists the halachos in Hilchos Sanhedrin, not in Hilchos Sanhedrin. So those are just 3 very quick shots. Does it apply to a katan? Some achronim want to claim that's why Kanaim Pogamo doesn't apply today. If you see a Jew committing that type of action, you can't take up your spear or your machine gun and mow them down. A, because we're living in Dina Mechusadina, but let's say we wouldn't be. Let's say we'd be living in a halachic state, Sharia, because we don't yet have a Beis Din. And without a Beis Din, you can't be a Shliach Beis Din, according to the Ravid. If you're a Shliach Beis Din, you can't be a Shliach Beis Din when there's no Beis Din. So in theory, we've lost Kanaim Pogimbo, according to that whole bank that views it as an extension of Beis Din, just like we've lost so many other Beis Din opportunities. We just don't have a Beis Din. It's so, when people have all these complaints about Judaism, it's just, you can't imagine how shorthanded we are in Judaism.
We don't have a Beis Din, we don't have a Melech, we don't have a Navi, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have a Kohen Gadol. We have barely 40% of our religion intact. And it's so impressive about how deep and rich Judaism is, even though it's 40% or 60% deficient. We have a Beis Din, so Iguna is not a problem, and Nevuah isn't a problem, and moral rectitude is less of a problem, because people go, in the days of Nevuah, you went to a Navi, and the Navi looked into your eyes and said, oh, this is what Hashem wants of you. This is how you should behave. This is the type of life. Al pi ruach hakodesh. You were able to be interviewed by Nevi'im. You're able, not psychologists. Not, wasn't Yom Yon for mental health. Navi said, this is how I think you should proceed religiously. This is how I think you can grow as a person, based on ruach hakodesh. We don't have ruach hakodesh anymore. Now, there's a riveting Ramban that I didn't put into the Makaris, and then we'll just see Rav and Shmuel. Ramban is an interesting question. See if you can take the logic here, okay? Because now we're transitioning. A lot of lamdas is turning one question into another question. So right now we have one question. One question is Kanaim Pogimbo, is it based in or is it separate? Nafkamina, Hasra, one, and Katan. Now I'm going to write this question in a different color of tush. I'm going to rewrite the question. What is he nenash for? What is the onesh for? The Avera? Or the Chilul Hashem? If essentially he's receiving an onesh based in, it's because he's committing an Avera. He's committing a very serious Avera. And based in, probably some of you happen to be based in here, but if it's not based in, you're just acting independently, it's because it's the Chilul Hashem that has to be halted. It's not really the Avera that's so terrible, it's the Chilul Hashem that's being caused. Do you see how I've changed the question on you? What Avera justifies Kanaim Pogimbo? The Avera or the Chilul Hashem? Not, I shouldn't say what Avera, what activity? Now this factors into two, should I say two? I'll just say one. Two very interesting questions. Is it reversible? What if it's a Jewish woman and a male Gentile? Hanivelas le'arami, not Habol Aramis, Hanivelas le'arami. What if it's not Zimri and Cosby, but some Jewish woman and Christopher? Can you still take the spear? It's a big, big machlokas. To a degree, it's tali upon, it's dependent upon this question. If the problem and the severity that invites Ebal Aramis is the Chilul Hashem of a Jew and a Gentile cohabitating, I mean, it depends if it's male, female, female, male. I mean, it depends if it's male, Jew, female, Gentile, then it's the same problem. But if it's the Avera, it's the cold, halachic Avera, so Avera is not reversible. It could be that a male having beer with a non-Jewish female has a level of chumrah that you just don't reach when the female has beer with it. So the Chilul Hashem component is weaker. There'd be no room to differentiate. So the Avera could be differentiatable. So you see how I've changed this question into this question? This question is, how do you view the Kanai? What's his status? But now I've changed it into, what is he punishing for? If he's based in his extension, he's punishing his own Avera, then in theory could have been administered to based in, he's just taking it into his own hands, as opposed to saying it's not based in, it's not an Avera, you're just stopping the Chilul Hashem and you're not doing it as based in. Let's just conclude with what I promised you before, the ability to look back and say, oh, now we understand. If you take a look at the Gemara in source number two, it's the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Pei Bezim and Aleph. Vichsiv, okay, you see the second paragraph, source two? Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar, Pinchas saw. Ma ra, what did he see? Amar Rav, ra maisa, he saw the episode unfolding. Viniskar halacha, remember that Moshe taught him in Har Sinai, the halacha of Kanaim Pogimbo. So remember they saw the story and he saw the halacha. Amar lo, he told his great uncle Moshe, Achi Avi Abba, you are the brother of my grandfather. My great uncle, brother of my grandfather, because Pinchas was the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron. So he said, my grandfather's brother, Lokach li maditani beretcha mehar sinai. Didn't you teach me this when you descended from Har Sinai, Bol Rams Kanaim Pogimbo? Amar lo, so Moshe tells Pinchas, oh, Karyar Deragarta, you're the one who read the letter, Yuvalevi Pavrakta, you be the intercessor. You know, you raise the issue, take care of it yourself. Shmuel Amar, Shmuel interprets the pasuk differently. Ma Ra, what did he see? Ra, she'ein chachma, ve'ein tvuna, ve'ein eitza neged Hashem. no games when it comes to Chilul Hashem. Kol makom sheish Chilul Hashem, ein chokum kavul arav. When there's Chilul Hashem, you got to step up and do something right away. Don't ein chachma, no tricks, no games, no discounts, no delay. Just get into it. So if I ask myself, I'm listening to Rav and Shmuel interpreting the conversation between Pinchas and Moshe, they have very different conversations. Rav's conversation sounds like Pinchas is acting as basis. He says, oh, there's halacha, Moshe, should they do it? Moshe says, you know what, you do it. Basically, Moshe's authorizing Pinchas. Moshe, I'm the Beis Din, you go take care of it. There's a halacha, he has to die, he committed a terrible sin, I don't have time for it, or you're the one that raised the issue, you attend to it. So basically, Rav viewed it this way. Shmuel is a whole different narrative. Pinchas doesn't ask Moshe. He sees the Chilul Hashem. He sees when it comes to Chilul Hashem, all hierarchies and protocols are out the window. Ein chachma, ein etza, ein tefura, ein neged Hashem. Because he's talking about a very different Balaram. He's talking about where you intercede to prevent a raging Chilul Hashem, and you don't follow the normal protocols. You don't deputize yourself as Beis Din. So here's a perfect example where had you just read Rav and Shmuel, okay, what have you on the law? What's the real difference? But now that in the later Rishonim and the Rambam and the Ravid and through our Lamed Shetulos we've created two different models, then their statements resonate with the differences that we see later. And that's how you learn Lamedus. You go downstream, you see a Reb Chaim, you see a Ketzos, you see, oh, now I better understand the Ramban and his Chilek with the Rashba. And you see a Ramban, and oh, now I better understand what Reb Yosef and Reb Nachman were talking about. Oh, now I better understand what Reb Akiva and Reb Meir were talking about, because they spoke, they knew it so well, they didn't have to articulate. They just said code words, and everyone in the room immediately knew what they were referring to. Okay? So I'll stop here. Enjoy the rest of my cake after Mincha. Ayin nut cake. Nothing like a good nut cake with some vanilla cream. I love it. It's very tasty for me. I'm attracted to it. I'm not going to say the word. Just to train you.